वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ Reading this morning from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 3. And the text is text is 22. This is just continuing in the description of the incarnations of the Supreme Lord. Again, the scene is a forest, the forest of Nainisharanya, and the sages have assembled. Sutta is speaking, and they're asking questions. One of the questions they've asked is, that same Supreme Lord who created the cosmic manifestation, from time to time he enters into this cosmic manifestation and appears in various forms or avatars. Can you describe those forms of the Lord as they appear in this world? So Sutta is obliging the sages. Both here, in the first canto, Sutta is describing what he heard from Shukadeva Goswami, who is speaking in the second canto. So what I've the list of incarnations is not exhaustive. In fact, Sutta says how many incarnations of the Lord there are, as many waves as there are in a river, in the rivulets within the river. So it's, how can you count them all? But I will need to describe principal ones, and one of them is Lord Ramachandra. So what I thought to do is to read and briefly discuss the verse. There's one verse in chapter 3. There's three verses in the second canto, chapter 7, that are discussing Ramchandra. There, for most of you, there's nothing new. Hearing about Ramchandra is not like, oh, I haven't heard that before. Oh, that's new and refreshing. But the topics of the personality of Godhead are ever fresh, and like chanting the Maha Mantra. Not that one needs some other sound vibrations in order to absorb the mind. Rather, with names of the Lord and the topics of Lord Ramchandra, the wish is to go more deeply and to appreciate the wonderful nature of the personality of Godhead as he's attracting the hearts and the minds of souls in the created realm to the spiritual realm. And particularly with Ramchandra's appearance, the scriptures teach us that each of the forms of the Lord, there's common things that are done, and there's unique features of each one. And the common things, they're mentioned in Bhagavad Gita. Pritranaya Satanam Vinashaya Chaduskritam. He gives protection to the saintly persons. He diminishes the influence, or annihilates, if necessary, the Duskritis, the demoniac personalities, and he establishes the principles of Dharma. Can we open this halfway? coach. We're good. I'm open to wide open. It's nice. Yeah. Okay. So those are universal things, forms of the Lord do those universal things, but each of the forms of the Lord has some specific character or quality that is being manifested. With Ramachandra, it's the ideal king. So in his Leela, as the ideal king, he appears very human-like. He's the son of Dasarath, he has brothers, he experiences apparently worldly emotions, worldly things, but then the other side is otherworldly things. So it makes it very clear he's not worldly, he's not of this world. So when he's the ideal king, he's showing ideal character, like the word of his father is his life and soul. His father says, become king, it's become king. His father says, don't become king, go to the forest, it's go to the forest. His life is simply to serve the will of his father, ideal king. Or Ekapatni Vrata, he takes one wife. Kings may have more than one wife. The ideal king is Ramachandra, showing by example one wife. And he upholds virtue. He gives his word, he keeps his word. Ideal king is not a politician. Say anything, do anything. The ideal king is you give your word, you uphold the word. Or there are codes of proper conduct expected of a king. He holds the mark of proper conduct. He'll never compromise from because of convenience or inconvenience or, oh, who cares, nobody's watching. Or you know, it's his, there's no public life, private life, is consistent. Ideal king. So that's the worldly side, Ram Raja. But because he's the personality of Godhead, by his mere presence, everything that is virtuous becomes strengthened. Everything that is different than virtue becomes diminished. And those who are determined to uphold non-virtue, they're dealt with, because that's the duty of the king. It's not the duty of man in the street, it's the duty of the king. So I thought what Vyasadeva decided to place in these verses, this third chapter, first canto, and the second canto, we'll just touch on those because the Ramayana can go on for weeks. So what's the exhaustive description of Lord Ram? This will take these highlights. In the 18th incarnation, the Lord appeared as King Ram. In order to perform some pleasing work for the demigods, he exhibited superhuman powers by controlling the Indian Ocean and then killing the atheist Ravana, who was on the other side of the sea in this other purport mentioned. Ravana was so powerful that King Indra, he was fighting King Indra once, and Airavata, the elephant, in the same spirit as King Indra was fighting against Ravana, he took his big, powerful trunk and smacked it against the body of Ravan, and this trunk flew in all directions in little pieces, and Ravan just laughed. And Indra was terrified. Powerful Ravana, but that same powerful Ravana who thought, because he had this power, who could kill him? Some measly mortal. Here's the king of heaven, intimidated by the power of Ravan. But Ramchandra, in Ravan's perspective, a mere mortal, an insect, as far as he was concerned, destroyed him, exhibiting extraordinary power. And so here's Prabhupada's purport. The personality of Godhead, Sri Rama, assumed the form of a human being and appeared on earth for the purpose of doing some pleasing work for the demigods or the administrative personalities to maintain the order of the universe. So the demigods had approached Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu indicated he would appear, and he appeared as Lord, because Ravana was tormenting not just the earth planet, but he was so powerful, he was able to move about through the creation and was terrorizing everybody, because he's an early time terrorist. And the demigods turned to Lord Vishnu, please help. So he came. Sometimes great demons and atheists like Ravana and Hiranyakashipu and many others become very famous due to advancing material civilization by the help of material science and other activities with the spirit of challenging the established order of the Lord. Prabhupada speaks about the scientists who want to send spacecrafts into space, and by doing so they reach the conclusion, just see, we can do all these things, there's no God. There was a video publication by the BBC interviewing scientists who were explicitly saying, our purpose of the advancement of science is to place God where he belongs, out of existence. I mean, so there are some people that have that disposition. Being puffed up by tiny material advancement, sometimes godless materialists challenge the existence of God. Ravana was one of them. He wanted to deport ordinary men to the planet of Indra, or heaven, by material arrangements, without considering the necessary qualifications. He wanted a staircase to be built directly reaching the heavenly planet so that people might not be required to undergo the routine pious work necessary to enter that planet. That's the Vedic model. There's a biblical model, the Tower of Babel, as with the Vedic model, the staircase to heaven. Who needs to do pious activities? Just build a staircase and go to heaven. He also wanted to perform other acts against the established rules of the Lord. He even challenged the authority of Sri Ram, the personality of Godhead, and kidnapped his wife, Sita. Of course, Lord Rama came to chastise this atheist, answering the prayer and the desire of the demigods. He therefore took up the challenge of Ravana, and the complete activity is the subject matter of the Ramayana. Because Lord Ramachandra was the personality of Godhead, he exhibited superhuman activities, which no human being, including the materially advanced Ravana, could perform. Lord Ramachandra prepared a royal road on the Indian Ocean with stones that floated on water. Note, stones don't float on water, but they floated on water by his mystic powers. Prabhupada writes, the modern scientists have done research in the area of weightlessness, but it is not possible to bring weightlessness anywhere and everywhere. Interesting way of saying it. So weightlessness is in space. Weight is due to force of gravity, science say. Mass brings gravity, and weightlessness is when you're off in space and you're distant from any big mass, so there's weightlessness. So how can you create weightlessness on the ocean? But because weightlessness is the creation of the Lord, by which he can make the gigantic planets fly and float in the air, he made the stones, even within this earth, to be weightless, and prepared a stone bridge on the sea without any supporting pillar. That is the display of the power of God. Ordinary people, when there's some ability for some individual to manifest powers that are not ordinary, they think, oh, this is God. An example, even a contemporary example, is Prapti City from yesterday, the list of eight mystic cities. So, if someone, and this is done from time to time in different places, someone can manifest in the palm of their hand some gold. The understanding from the Vedic text is that's Prapti City, there's gold, and by approaching higher dimensional space, or I wish I was Sataputta who could explain. There's our plane, by theoretical physics, there's dimensions of space. So on our plane, we can't reach out our hand to Afghanistan and get a pomegranate. Or we can't reach to a remote place and put in our hand some gold. But those that know this subtle science of higher dimensional space can do that. That's something that already exists, and just bring it through higher dimensional space here. There's something like that happened with, you mentioned this yesterday, with Madhvacharya. Madhvacharya was wanting to get verification from Vyasadeva about his commentary on Bhagavad Gita. And to get that verification, it was to be done in person. It wasn't like in a dream, or, you know, I had this flash of lightning come and suddenly I realized that Vyasa approved of my Bhagavad Gita commentary. He went to meet Vyasadeva. And to meet Vyasadeva, he went on a pilgrimage all the way from Udupi north, and as he was traveling north, he was encountering different individuals and having discussions and spiritual topics. In fact, to this day, during the Kartik month, the followers of Madhvacharya take a Utsav Murti of Madhvacharya on pilgrimage as part of their annual practice and visit the very same places that Madhvacharya visited again and again and again. So one of those places is Vrindavan. That's how I happen to know, because they come and visit at our Krishna Balaram temple in Vrindavan. You know, a number of very elderly, very sober and wise Madhvacharya followers. So as he continued to travel north, he went to the Himalayas, and as he went to the Himalayas, he went to Badrinath, and there was one disciple of Madhvacharya who was his one of the most learned followers or disciples, and he wanted to, while the others were sleeping, Madhvacharya told, "I'm going to see Vyas, but you won't be able to follow me, so don't even try." But he tried, because he didn't want to bear separation from Madhvacharya, but Madhvacharya, being a form of Hanuman, he was able to, or Vayu, he was able to move in such leaps and bounds that the follower couldn't keep up with him in this mountainous area of Badrinath. And then the biography describes how he entered into the upper regions of Badri. I mentioned this yesterday, but regions of Badrinath. So he went by his spiritual power. Anyway, there are regions that, according to some descriptions, they're not accessible if one doesn't have higher consciousness. Something like, you know, even with your modern technology, you can create a program that without passwords you can't get access to certain information. And, you know, you get to give the password, and you get into that area, and then another password, another area, and so on. With credential, one can enter into more confidential regions. So anyway, the personality of Godhead, when he appears in this world, he's accessible to everybody. No password, no special credential. But the persons that are inimical, they don't see like that. They see that what Ravana saw was, I'm a great mystic, powerful person. I can transform myself into different shapes. I can fly in the air. I can do this. And here's this other person, and he has some mystic powers. But I'm confident my mystic powers are greater than his mystic powers. So I'll fight him. And because he was of a demoniac spirit, his way of fighting or his way of conducting his life was in violation of dharma, of codes of religion. And because he is such an adharmic person, that was the cause of his defeat. Even his own ministers told him again and again and again, give up this lusty ambition to enjoy Sita. This will bring the ruination of our whole dynasty, our whole group. Give it up. He couldn't give it up. It brought his ruination. So by violation of dharma, however powerful somebody may be, by violation of dharma one becomes destroyed ultimately. Although he became terribly powerful. As the saying goes, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. So here's three verses in the second canto, chapter 7, where Lord Rama is also spoken of, this time by Shukadeva Goswami directly. Due to his causeless mercy upon all living entities within the universe, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, along with his plenary expansions, appeared in the family of Maharaj Ikshvaku as the Lord of his internal potency Sita, under the order of his father, Maharaj Dasharath. He entered the forest and lived there for considerable years with his wife and younger brother. Ravana was very materially powerful, with 10 heads on his shoulders, committed a very great offense against him, and was thus ultimately vanquished. So, here we go. In the first paragraph, Prabhupada is explaining that some commentators of Ramayana speak of Ram as the Lord and his brothers as jiva souls, and it's not so. The expansions of, according to the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam, each of the four brothers were forms of the Chaturvyuha. Here's how it's explained in the purport. Originally, Lord Ramachandra is the incarnation of Vasudev. His brother Lakshman is the incarnation of Sankarshan. Bharat is the incarnation of Pradyumna, and Shatrughna is the incarnation of Aniruddha. So, in the spiritual realm, the Supreme Lord Narayan exists, and he expands as his, using a British term, Prabhupada has used this phrase, aides de camp. I don't know exactly what that means, but like chief officers, like a general and his chief officers, aides de camp. So Narayan expands as Vasudeva, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, and Sankarshan. These are of the same category or same tattva as Narayan, but they have specific services unto Narayan. So there's that relationship of equal of spiritual potency or position, but a mood of wanting to serve. So those same four descend. When Ramchandra descends, he is one of those four, Vasudev, and Sankarshan is Lakshman. So wherever Ram goes to the forest, Lakshman goes with him. Where Vasudev goes, Sankarshan goes. Like, you know, Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, or Krishna and Balaram, same. This is higher spiritual science, this graduate study, but the according to the authorities of the Srimad Bhagavatam and other Vedic literature, those that give us information of the spiritual realm, these features are there. So Prabhupada's example is when we say, the king is coming, the king is coming, or in our case, you know, the governor of Pennsylvania is going to visit Penn State. If that were to happen, it's not like, you know, the governor comes on a bicycle or walking down the road by himself. He'll come with a whole entourage of people. And same with the Supreme Lord. When he appears with this whole assembly of those who are associating with him in the spiritual realm. I'm going to have to excuse myself one more time. Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada has explained like this. Undergraduate, Bhagavad Gita. Graduate, Srimad Bhagavatam. Postgraduate, Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, when speaking in an informal setting like this, I've been speaking in the mornings on Srimad Bhagavatam. But for persons that aren't, you know, aren't accustomed to Bhagavad Gita or the undergraduate, you don't just jump to the graduate. So I would have chosen a different topic. But what I've been doing, had I known you had been here, but what I've been doing is sequentially going through particularly the first and second cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, because it's described in another one of the Vedic literatures that this Srimad Bhagavatam is a literary manifestation, literary incarnation of Krishna. And the first two cantos are the lotus feet of that literary incarnation. So one who approaches the lotus feet, you've reached the person in a humble mood. So in these first two cantos, there are verses, a section, because it's a question that's being asked, what are the forms of the Lord that appear and in this world? Can you describe them and their pastimes? So that's what we're doing. And I was thinking as I'm explaining this, this is far out. Floating stones on the ocean and higher dimensions of reality and those things are better understood in context of having a clear, at least a reasonable understanding of Bhagavad Gita. Like the difference between the body and the soul. And we're not the body. We're spirit soul. And so forth. You know, just fundamentals before appreciating the forms of the Lord as they descend in this world and how he exhibits divinity. You know, things that are beyond our capacity should be expected to be exhibited by one who is beyond our capacity. And he does. And when he does, persons who have a bodily conception of life, I am this body, when they hear the descriptions of the opulences of the personality body, whose, you know, potencies are way beyond us, it's, you know, what's that about? That sounds like fiction or fantasy or, you know, la-la land. What are these people doing? But it's one of our acharyas, Jiva Goswami, writes, this is a very reasonable statement, without accepting that God has inconceivable potencies, there's no question of understanding God. And all religions have some language or some notion that says God is all-powerful, the omnipotent or the almighty. So Vedas say the same, and then they describe some of those potencies that are exhibited by the all-powerful, the almighty, the omnipotent. And those potencies are beyond our capacity. They're not creations of a fiction writer. Rather, they're historical records of the personality of Godhead appearing and exhibiting his divinity. And it's part of the beauty of Ramachandra's pastimes in that he simultaneously appears to be human, like one of us, like even fallible, like us, like the fallible notion of going to chase the golden deer, when if he's omnipotent and omniscient, surely he must have known. that's not a golden deer, that's Marici, pretending to be a golden deer, only to allure me away so that Ravan can come and kidnap Sita. I mean, he's omniscient, he knows that. So why is he making this mistake? I was at a gathering in Hyderabad with Prabhupada, and the man who donated the land for the Hyderabad temple to be built. And that, don't be surprised, his name was Mr. Reddy. In America, it's like saying Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones. In Hyderabad or in Andhra Pradesh, Reddy is such a common name. Mr. Reddy, to get his first name, donated the land. So he had invited... We had gone from Mayapur, about 100 plus, 120 in car trains, booked whole cars to go from Calcutta to Hyderabad by train, and then the plan was we would spend 7 days in Hyderabad conducting Pandal program with Srila Prabhupada, and then catch a train back to Delhi and go to Vrindavan for the rest of the festival, from Mayapur to Vrindavan festival. So while we're in Hyderabad, the man who donated the land invited all the devotees to come to his home for lunch. So we went to his home for lunch, and Prabhupada was inside the house. There were so many devotees who were out in the yard, outside the house. So I took prasadam very quickly and went into the house to hear Prabhupada speaking with the family. And so the ladies of the family, the wife and her friends, were not in a challenging spirit, but kind of like, you know, a persistent spirit, were asking this question: why did Ram make a mistake? He's God. Why did he make a mistake? And their issue was, you know, he went chasing the deer. And if he's God, he surely knew this isn't a deer. And even Lakshman said, and still Ram went for it. And why did he make that mistake? And such serious consequences for his mistake. Sita was kidnapped, so much trouble finding Sita, big battle, and they went on and on and on. Yeah, it's more interesting. Exactly. But Prabhupada, hope the ladies don't mind Prabhupada's answer. First he was saying, it's Leela. It's interesting. It's his pastime. And he's omniscient, he's just enjoying the pastime. And they said, yes, but Sita was in such difficulty. And, you know, kidnapped by Ravan, and Ram was her husband. He's to protect his wife, and he left her alone, and all these bad things happened. Why did Ram make that mistake? They just kept hammering on the same point. And finally, Prabhupada said, the message of this pastime was, if you become too much attached, even you are the personality of Godhead. You become too much attached to your wife, you'll have a problem. And they looked at each other and started giving Prabhupada a problem. But yes, but Swamiji, why is it like this? And Prabhupada turned to his sannyas disciples and just smiled and laughed. And the sannyasis got it, and they didn't get it. They were just, you know, giving Prabhupada a problem. So, in the role, seemingly worldly, I mean, what Ram showed to show his prowess, his taking an arrow and piercing it through seven sal trees. I mean, sal trees are hardwood trees and they're thick. And you're an arrow through one tree and out the other side and into another tree and out the other, seven sal trees. and then entering into the ground and coming back to his quiver. That's not like a magic trick. That's the personality of Godhead. The monkey warriors, where they were impressed. Whoa, he's good. He's got power, this person. But it's not, so certainly there's such things as fairy tales and mythology and all of that stuff. Is it not possible for the personality of Godhead to appear? And if he exists, and he's almighty, he can appear. He can do whatever he likes. He cannot be visible, he can be visible. Again, Jiva Goswami's comment, if one doesn't accept that God has all powers, God is all powerful. If you say no, not all powerful, then there's no question of God, or what to speak of understanding God. And if there is God, he must be all powerful. And if he's all powerful, then he can exhibit his powers at will, and he can withhold them at will. And so this is a description in revealed scripture, using our biblical phrase of revealed scripture, that is, God is revealing himself. I am like this. So he performs his pastimes, and he has those pastimes written by his literary incarnation, Vyasadeva, to describe. Now, next is, who is Sita? Sita is Lakshmiji, or the goddess of fortune. But she is never to be enjoyed by any living being. She is meant for being worshipped by the living being along with her husband, Sri Ramachandra. A materialistic man like Ravana does not understand this great truth, but on the contrary, he wants to snatch Sita Devi from the custody of Ram and thus incurs great miseries. The materialists, similarly, who are after opulence and material prosperity, may take lessons from the Ramayana that the policy of exploiting the nature of the Lord without acknowledging the supremacy of the Supreme Lord is the policy of Ravan. Ravan was very advanced materially, so much so that he turned his kingdom, Lanka, into pure gold or full material wealth. But because he did not recognize the supremacy of Lord Ramachandra and defied him by stealing his wife, Sita, Ravana was killed, and all his opulence and power were destroyed. I'll just read the verses for the next two, and we'll end there. The personality of Godhead, Ramachandra, being aggrieved for his distant intimate friend Sita, glanced over the city of the enemy, Ravana, with red hot eyes like those of Hara, who wanted to burn the kingdom of heaven. The great ocean, trembling in fear, gave him his way, because its family members, the aquatics, like the sharks, snakes, and crocodiles, are being burnt by the heat of the angry, red-hot eyes of the Lord. Just one comment. There are different versions of the Ramayana, and this is in reference to the ancient version of Ramayana, the Valmiki Ramayana, and one that's more modern with some embellishments is the Tulsi Ramayana. In the Tulsi Ramayana, it speaks of Ram sending arrows into the ocean. The Bhagavatam speaks of Ram glancing over the ocean. So, in the beginning of the ninth canto, where there's several chapters, not just verses, but chapters about Ramachandra's pastimes. Shukadeva Goswami says, and this is 5,000 years ago, which is because Kali Yuga is now more advanced. 5,000 years ago, he said that there's many versions of the Ramayana, and I only speak from the authorized ones. So, when one reads spiritual texts, one should be very careful selecting an authentic version, because there's such a thing as those that aren't. Renderings that are quite speculative. Like I was sharing yesterday, that my first encounter with Bhagavad Gita. And, you know, for those of you that are from India, you grew up with Bhagavad Gita. It's not like, what was my first encounter with Bhagavad Gita? It's just, it's part of your life. But for someone from America, there was a time when I never heard of it before. So that encounter was, interesting. And I didn't have Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, but I had another Bhagavad Gita. And it was incomprehensible. It was profound and deep and incomprehensible. Because the person that had translated it was a scholar, and with scholarship you can't enter into the mystery of Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada gives the example, it's like during the daytime taking a flashlight and looking for the sun. You don't need a flashlight to find the sun. The sun is self-effulgent. You see the sun, oh, there's the sun. That's what the sun is. There's where it is. So the speculative powers of a scholar to find the message of Bhagavad Gita, it's the wrong approach. The right approach is, as Krishna describes within the Gita itself, it's a descending form of knowledge that comes through disciplic succession, and then it's very luminous, brilliant, very, very easy to understand. So, same with the pastimes of Ram, scholarship, and even, you know, sentiment towards Ramachandra or towards Krishna may very easily result in a misunderstanding. Sentiment alone and scholarship alone are not going to bring understanding or realization. So, according to the Bhagavatam, the eyes of when Ramachandra underwent, here's another human-like thing, he underwent austerity. The request was for the ocean personified to assist him to cross to Lanka. And he didn't pay any attention. But when Ramachandra glanced upon the ocean with red-hot eyes, that those eyes were making the ocean so hot, boiling. You know, try to have a big feast and you have to cook for like 50 people, and how long does it take to boil a pot of water for making rice? Looking at the ladies. You would have that service. So, it takes a while to boil a big pot of water for the rice. What to speak of? An ocean. But he's all powerful. So, just by his eyes, he was able to boil the ocean water, and all the aquatics were freaking out. So hot. So Samudra came, and with folded palms, begged Ramchandra for forgiveness. I didn't understand who you were, now I understand who you are. Whatever it is that you want, I'm ready. Very good. Please assist me to cross the ocean. Someone that can boil the ocean doesn't need a help to get across the ocean. That's a lila. It's inviting those who are perhaps proud of some opulence to relinquish the pride. and serve without pride. Just an opportunity for Samudra to have some service. And so he granted that request, that you can place rocks for the bridge that you want to cross over to Lanka, and I'll see that they float. But it, you know, it's not he that's seeing that they're going to float, it's Ramchandra who's seeing that they're going to float. But he gives the credit to Samudra. Okay, you take the credit. Very good. And that's the way of devotional service. What is it that anyone has that's a power or capacity separate from God? What is that that exists apart from its source of emanation? Some ability, some energy, some talent, some opulence, something. In the language of Srimad Bhagavatam, one who sees like that, know that to be my illusory energy. Seeing something, the language is, that which appears to have value in and of itself apart from the Supreme, know that to be my illusory energy. It's one of the Chatur-Sloki verses of the Bhagavatam. Lord Vishnu is explaining to Brahma. Everything that exists, say it positively, everything that exists has its connection with the Supreme. In reverse, something that exists apart from the Supreme, seeing like that, that's the influence of the illusory energy. And how does one enter into that reality? By the medium of devotional service. Last verse. When Ravana was engaged in the battle, the trunk of the elephant which carried the king of heaven, Indra, broke in pieces, having collided with the chest of Ravana, and the scattered broken parts illuminated all directions. Ravana, therefore, felt proud of his prowess, and began to loiter in the midst of the fighting soldiers, thinking himself the conqueror of all directions. But his laughter, overtaken by joy, along with his air of life, suddenly ceased with the tingling sound of the bow of Ramachandra, the personality of Godhead. One sentence purport will end. Prabhupada writes, however powerful a living being may be, when he is condemned by God, no one can save him. And similarly, however weak one may be, if he is protected by the Lord, no one can annihilate him. So any discussion about Ramachandra or whatever you'd like to discuss? Something burning? I've not heard it one way or the other. I've heard what I just expressed several times. Anything else? Yes?
What is the difference between Garbhodakshayavishnu and Kshiradakshayavishnu?
What's the difference? It's a difference of function. In one sense, all three of the Purusha avatars, they're one entity, but they're differentiated by name as well as by function. So Garbhodakshaya Vishnu expands the universe. He enters within each universe, and by his presence the universe expands. Kshiradakshaya Vishnu enters within the heart of every living being. He's an expansion of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu and enters within the heart of every living being and within every atom of material nature. And in that way, he's all-pervasive. So the super soul is said to be all-pervasive by his expanding. That's Chiradakshaya Vishnu, by his expansion within every atom of matter, every soul. So it's a function.
So Mahavishnu is rather, one step ahead of the other expansion.
One step ahead. Yeah. He emanates the universes and expands himself within each universe. And then he who expands himself within every universe expands himself. But it's not within every atom. But it's not that by expanding, each expansion becomes weakened, but each expansion is of the same potency. Like the lighting of candles from an original candle. Each candle that's lit from an original candle is of the same potency. The same category, or same tattva, Vishnu tattva. But they're differentiated by function. And the overall function is creation. Meaning that in the spiritual sky, where there's no material energy, there's no touch of material energy, those forms of Vishnu are not present, because the function is the function of creation. Rather, they're manifest instead as by another name, Sankarshan, he who sustains the spiritual realm. It's different names of different features. The external energy does different things. Durga has a function. She maintains, or she oversees, she's in charge of the prison house and the material creation. She's in charge. And Maya deludes the living entity. This particular function. Yeah.
I have a question. Might not be nice, it's fine. But why would God show himself, personally, whatever, itself, only in a specific period of time, and only in a specific place, and nowhere else, and not different times?
In one sense, he's showing himself all the time through the agency of his energy. We're not able to detect because we're under the influence of Maya, Devi, or under the influence of the deluding potency. Just like this description that you were giving me yesterday, when the veil of Maya is removed, one can see, or one can experience, a universal presence in all things. So why is that Maya curtain placed? The Maya curtain is placed because persons are inimical towards him, so he doesn't appear before them. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita, Naham prakasha sarvasya yoga maya samavita mutoyam nabhi janati. So the verse is saying, for persons who are inimical towards me, the word is mudha. Literally, it means foolish. For those who are inimical towards me, I don't appear before them. I conceal myself by my yogamaya potency, by my deluding potency. Because they got an attitude that says, get out of my face. So he doesn't, that's our American expression. But no, I don't want to see you. So he conceals himself. And for those who are inclined towards him, he shows himself, and he may show himself in a variety of ways. He may show himself through his potencies. He may show himself personally. He may show himself unto the yogi who is seeing that form of the Lord within his heart. He's forever inviting persons to become qualified, and then when persons become qualified, then he shows himself. Like there's a biblical saying, do not cast your pearls before swine. You're familiar with that one, right? Not heard of that one? Do you have a biblical background at all? Okay. That's a biblical saying. Something that is of great value, don't present that thing that's of great value to persons that don't know how to handle something of great value. They'll abuse it. Don't cast your pearls before swine. So persons that are nasty and inimical, vicious, vile, hatred, the Lord doesn't disclose himself before those persons. But sometimes, even before those persons, he'll appear, particularly at the request of those who are saintly and elevated souls, and they're very much intimidated by these vicious people. Please help us. So he may come in those circumstances and relieve the world of that burden. By relieving the world of that burden, it means the souls become, their disposition becomes mitigated by his presence, or they're relieved of those sinful reactions and the souls are liberated. So when he does come, so it's not in all circumstances that he comes, but when he does come, it's an act of mercy for all. And so now we're at a time in the history of the world where there's, at least according to the Vedic teachings, there's not a form of the Lord present on this earth. The next incarnation of the Lord is scheduled, forecast, predicted to come at the end of this age of Kali. And everyone will get a chance to see him. Between now and then, the means of his being present has been given in a literary form and in a sound vibration form. So persons that want access can have it. And when that qualification of being in a purified state of consciousness, that great appreciation is there. Those that aren't qualified can't see, just like when Ramchandra was present. Ravana, we were just reading, he thought of him as a person like me. Powerful, but I'm more powerful. I'll annihilate him. He saw him as a worldly being. And others saw him as an otherworldly being. The Lord of their life. Someone else? Yes?
You know that yesterday you were mentioning in the next night, Yama and Yama.
Okay, last night, yeah?
In the Yama, the last thing was like Ishwara Panitam, like engaging in devotion service. So I was just wondering why, if you were engaging in devotion service, is a topmost form of.
It's it's an ethic or a value to aspire for. It's, you know, it's taking the injunctions and the prohibitions. So the injunction is, come to that stage. Now here's the method. One of the, after the class, there was somebody that came forward who was practicing a particular type of yoga. And the particular type of yoga that he's practicing is done the way that it should be done. Before you begin your practice, you invoke, bring your attention to ethics and standards and codes of life to live by, virtues and values of life to live by. That's the yama and niyama, things not to do, injunctions and prohibitions. So it's a fixing the mind that this yoga practice that I'm about to do, ultimately it's meant so that I can connect with the Supreme and engage myself in service under the Supreme. It's a value or a virtue to aspire for and cultivate. Good question. How do we apply that is, when we hear, it should, the best is in a receiving mode, rather than, now all of my academic training has been to figure it out. So let me see how I can apply my academic prowess to figure it out. How does this work? The prohibition is, you won't be able to understand that way. It's not an academic affair or academic subject matter. It's not that power of discrimination is trashed, but it's not that, on the other hand, it's not that by power of discrimination that's the resource, the sole resource that you have to work with. The primary resource is recognizing that descending knowledge is something that you receive. You evaluate it, you look upon it with your discriminating power, recognizing the limitations of discriminating power. That's not the sum and substance of receiving this. I'll give a very simple example. You're not this body. So we can analyze with our power of discrimination, how we're not this body, and why is it so? Or take the lessons of Bhagavad Gita and take the lessons of science. Two lessons of Bhagavad Gita. Dehinosmin yata dehe komaram yohanam jara. So the verse is describing, just as in this life, there's the baby. From babyhood, one goes to boyhood, from boyhood to youthhood, youthhood to old age. There's a continuing sense of, this is me, this is me, this is me, this is me. But the body has changed. Not just grown, but the cells of the body have changed. If that was me, then I'm gone. And then there's another me, and then there's another me. But there's not that sense of multiple me's. It's a continuing sense of me, but the body is changing. So there's something unchanging. And this is like, our reasoning faculty. There's something unchanging. And as with that change of body, so also one can understand by inference, when the body is not just changed as in gradual stages, but changed altogether, the soul continues. That conscious, aware self that's distinct from the changes of body, that continues. So that's our reasoning faculty. And Krishna presents it in Bhagavad Gita. But that's different than realization of I'm not this body. the realization of I'm not this body is not obtained by reasoning faculty. I can reach the conclusion I'm not this body by reasoning. And then, you know, a little pinprick and it's ouch. It hurts. I'm this body and it hurts. So, you know, there's a distinction between understanding and realization. So this knowledge is meant to be received. We employ, Krishna invites us, use your reasoning faculty, but the essence of it is not just as the extent of your reasoning faculty. If that's so, there won't be realization. At best, one will realize what I'm not, but to realize what one is by descending. So when you read Bhagavad Gita, best to read in receiving mode. Use your discerning faculties, but when the mercy of Krishna is, when the heart is open sufficiently and the mercy of Krishna comes, then you'll have a realization that's not dependent upon, you know, whether there's a pinprick or not. And it's like with detachment, oh, the body has a leak now. Due to that pinprick, I think I better put something on it. But it's not identifying. It's, you know, it's as much as there might get a rip in my cloth. I have to patch the rip in the cloth. Or throw it away and get another one. With detachment, based upon realization. And so, same about Krishna. Like in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks. Arjuna asks, please describe ways in which I can always think of you. So Krishna obliges him and says, you can think of me in this way. In the opulences of this world, of the light, I am the sun and the moon. I'm the prowess of all powerful men. I'm the strength of the strong, of the mountains, of the Himalayas, and of fishes, I am the shark, and so on and so on. But what is the use, Arjuna, of all these opulences? They are but a spark of my splendor. It just gives us an idea of, like, in that direction, that of whatever is magnificent and great in this world, those opulences of Krishna give us an idea of that Krishna is present. Just like right now, there's the light of the sun within this room, which would be different if we closed the curtain or it was night. We're not directly seeing the sun, but we know the sun is present because of the sunlight. Similarly, this is, like, you know, part of continuing answering to your question. Krishna's presence can be detected by his opulences. Without his presence, there wouldn't be his opulences. Without the sun being above the horizon, he wouldn't have sunlight. The sky would not be lit up. So by inference, we can understand Krishna's presence. But that's different than realizing Krishna face to face. It's the indication he exists. But it's a whole other, so how do you realize Krishna? It's not by reasoning faculty, by speculation. Krishna exists. I can infer and become convinced of God exists. It's a whole other thing to experience. And that's the message of Bhagavad Gita, or the message of descending knowledge, is to give us that direct experience, which he says in the 9th chapter. By this confidential knowledge, you can have direct perception of the self by realization. That's not, you know, reasoning and astute intellectual capacity. We can use that stuff, but that's not going to give us final convincing realization of Krishna's existence, the descending mercy. And our wish is to prepare ourselves to receive that mercy. And then ask Krishna to bestow it. That's bhakti.
Do you feel the mercy?
Huh? Oh, sure. Just like, you know, do you feel the rays of the sun? Is it possible that such a feeling is flawed? That's your question?
Not such a feeling, but feelings are flawed in general.
Feelings are, yeah, and but is it possible? I can say it as a question. Is it possible that the original nature of the soul can be restored? And that means where filters are removed and feelings are not flawed? In this world, it's hard to find such a being, but is it possible? According to Bhagavad Gita, the answer is a strong yes. That requires purification. And then another point is, there's checks and balances so we can evaluate our feelings. In spiritual circles, there's scripture, there's our teachers, guru, and there's saintly persons throughout all the history of mankind, the most exalted, universally recognized sadhus or saintly persons. On their authority, we can take our feelings and hold it up to those three tests and see, does it match? If it doesn't match, then we, you know, deposit it in the circular file. But if it matches, then we can accept. Yes. How do you evaluate the degree of submissive attitude? Well, there's external, there's internal. External is a little bit like what Krishna, your question is a little bit like Arjuna's question to Arjuna, excuse me, to Krishna in chapter 14. What are the symptoms of one who's beyond the modes of nature? That's his question. How does he sit? How does he walk? And most importantly, how does he achieve that state? So, where an external is in the form of consistent actions that are according to some instructions received, like let's say, you know, a teacher says to their student, "Okay, can you recite your ABCs?" And they recite their ABCs. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, da, 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 da. So that's a behavior. So with spiritual master and a disciple or student, all the foods that you eat should first be offered to Krishna. So then there's a behavior. So that's one sign. Those very firm, clear, strong indications, they're consistently performed. But that behavior rests upon something internal. Something internal is a mood of submission. In the language of Bhagavad Gita, pranipat, submission. The very term itself indicates a false ego-less submission. Like what Sanatan Goswami, when he spoke with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, said, "I come before you like a blank slate. Here's the board. Here's the chalk. Write on the slate. Tell me, who am I? And what is my duties in life? What are my duties in life?" It's not like, you know, whatever you say, I'll think about it. I'll let you know what I think about it. So, it's that's who I am. It's that there's submission, or it's with feeling. In that relationship, that's, you know, that's Sanatana Goswami. But you know, let's say come down to like our level, and where there's submission, that's the strength of the relationship. It's not on the other end, oh boy, now I've got, you know, I'm the enjoyer of the submission. It's a relationship, just like friend and friend, or husband and wife, or lover and beloved. If it's genuine love, they're not thinking, oh, this is great, now I can exploit the other person. And they're submissive. But it's like with Krishna. It's his devotee submits unto him, and Krishna submits unto his devotee. Krishna becomes controlled by the love and submission of his devotee. At the same time, he's fully independent. So the measure is the measure of an internal mood of my life is simply to serve. And the object is Krishna and Krishna's representatives. Okay? Yes?
In the association of devotees, if to keep the association together, is it our responsibility? And if it is our responsibility, and if it is our responsibility, and if that is breaching etiquette to some extent, should we do it or not? Yeah.
That's a loaded question. I'm inclined to answer your question this way. As long as we think that we're independent, there will never be any happiness or smooth social intercourse. It's chaos. The safe position is being under the shelter of persons who are very dear to Krishna. That's our safe position. So we want to bring others into that safe position. We shouldn't go outside of that safe position in order to accomplish, you know, a laudable goal of bringing others and securing others in the safe shelter of Krishna and his representatives. We ourselves should stay under that shelter and be inviting to come to that shelter. And there's, you know, certain lines we won't cross that take us outside that shelter. We can be forever inviting, as Krishna is forever inviting. We don't cross certain positions of safety and protection, because then we're at risk. like Ram Rekha. Sita, just stay inside. You're protected. So we don't go outside. Desiring, inviting, encouraging, but not crossing.